Translation: O rishis, who are as powerfully pure as the sun, I shall try to describe to you the transcendental pastimes of Vishnu as far as my knowledge is concerned. As the birds fly in the sky, as far as their capacity allows, so do the learned devotees describe the Lord as far as their realization allows. Brilliant. So the purport is the supreme absolute truth is unlimited. No living being can know about the unlimited by his limited capacity. The Lord is impersonal, personal, and localized. By his impersonal feature, he is all-pervading Brahman. By his localized feature, he is present in everyone's heart as the supreme soul. And by his ultimate personal feature, he is the object of transcendental loving service by his fortunate associates, the pure devotees. The pastimes of the Lord in different features can only be estimated partly by the great learned devotees. So Srila Suta Goswami has rightly taken this position in describing the pastimes of the Lord as far as he has realized. Factually, only the Lord himself can describe himself, and his learned devotees, also can describe him as far as the Lord gives him the power of description. So I'll just repeat the verse again. Aham hi prishto aryamano bhavadbir achaksha atma vagamotrayavan nabha patantyatma samam patatrinas tatha samam vishnu gatim vipaschitaha. O rishis, who are as powerfully pure as the sun, I shall try to describe to you the transcendental pastimes of Vishnu as far as my knowledge is concerned. As the birds fly in the sky as far as their capacity allows, so do the learned devotees describe the Lord as far as their realization allows. Okay, Hare Krishna, everyone. So, very interesting verse. And obviously, it looks like at the moment, Suta Goswami, he's actually really kind of setting the scene, shall we say, of what's about to transpire. So, Suta Goswami is obviously there with the sages assembled at Naimisharanya. And, you know, he's glorifying Maharaj Parikshit, Sukadev Goswami, and then the Lord, and then each other, you know, Suta Goswami and the sages, they start glorifying each other. And whilst they're glorifying each other, the yajna is going on, and everyone is ready to find out the narrations of the unlimited of the Lord, as was spoken by Maharaj Parikshit. Okay, so what Suta Goswami is doing here, he's setting the scene, because literally after this verse onwards, Suta Goswami is going to basically go into the story of how Maharaj Parikshit actually got cursed by a Brahmin boy, okay, Shringi, son of Shamika Rishi, right? So it's interesting because what he's doing, often, you know, when we give presentations, we put in certain disclaimers, we obviously put, you know, we obviously first, you know, acknowledge our limitations and just seeking prayers for what we're going to do. So same way, Suta Goswami is doing the same thing here. Before he goes on, he's actually showing his utter like humility and actually showing his limitations of what he can and can't give in terms of the discourse that he's going to go on to now. And, you know, this discourse in one sense is like the apex moment of his life. You know, he'll be known forever in history as the person who gave the Bhagavatam to the sages of Naimisharanya, from where we are now learning it here. So there's a few things that are coming across in this verse. One is this understanding that we have limitations, not just we, but even great learned devotees have limitations in how far they can describe the Lord. Okay, and this has been coming across so much in the verse. Okay, the pastimes of the Lord can only be estimated partly by the great learned devotees. Okay, Suta Goswami goes on to Prabhupada actually then says in the purport, Suta Goswami actually says that He will describe the pastimes of the Lord as far as he has realized. Okay? And then he goes on to say, the learned devotees can describe him as far as the Lord gives them the power of description. Okay? And, you know, even the when Sutta Goswami is speaking to the rishis, he's saying that, you know, there are different birds of different strengths and they're flying in the sky. And literally, as you know, some birds will have more capacity to fly higher and fly further, and others not so. So as far as I'm concerned, I'll describe the Lord's glories as far as my realization takes me. Okay? This is a very important thing here. So a few things I want to look at is, what are the limitations that great learned devotees have in describing the unlimited? And if that's the case, if there are limitations, what allows us to go forward with our descriptions of the Lord? Like for learned devotees, if they're limited, what factor can allow them to break through the limitations? Maybe, possibly. Okay? And then based on those limitations, how do great devotees try to describe the Lord? Okay? With that in mind, then we look at how do we apply this in our modern day approach to scriptures? Okay? So we're looking at limitations. What factor allows us to then go beyond our limitations and basically trying to delve into spiritual topics and understandings and descriptions? And how, with these limitations in place, what should be our approach in the modern day with scriptures? And another thing I want to also touch on is that if a great and learned devotee has limitations in describing spiritual topics, then what exactly is it that makes them great and learned? Okay, what exactly is it that makes them great learned? Okay, so let's look at the limitations first. I remember this actually earlier this week, Taruna Prabhu, he was giving a class, I believe it was on, yesterday was Ravitanandam Prabhu, then it was Prajana Prabhu, the day before, I think it was Tuesday, yeah. Tuesday, Taruna Prabhu was giving a class and he mentioned how the Lord is unlimited. Okay, so like, and he gave the example of the Lord makes a boulder that he can't move and then he moves it, right? So this actually demonstrates the Lord's ever-expanding potency. So there, you already got a limitation there, that how can we, with our limited intelligence and understanding, describe something that completely confounds, you know, logic and rationality? Like he creates something that has a function, then he goes against it. Because that's something the Lord can do, we can't. Okay? And then, of course, his unlimited glories, how can we even describe it? There's a nice verse in the Garga Samhita in Canto 1, Chapter 5, Verse 38, where Narad Muni is actually describing to King Bahulashwa about the Lord's appearances and his features. And there's a beautiful verse where he says, Roma matram tano jiva bhavantitam yada nitpa tadapi shri haresh tashya varanyate na guno mahan. King, if I had as many tongues as there are hairs on my body, I could still not properly describe Sri Hari's great and glorious qualities. Okay, so this is Narad Muni, one of the most powerful devotees in our lineage, in Vedic culture, and he himself would describe, saying that I can't describe actually the Lord in his entirety. And this is also echoed by Ananta Shesh, right? You know, we know the whole example of Ananta Shesh, where he's got unlimited mouths and he's constantly reciting glories of Krishna, of Vishnu, but still, he's still not fulfilling the full entirety of how much he can actually give in terms of his descriptions. Okay, and actually, it goes on even further. In the Bhagavatam, in the 10th canto, chapter 87, verse 1. Parikshit Maharaj himself, who Sutta Goswami will be talking about very soon now, right? Parikshit Maharaj actually says, the verse is, Sri Parikshit Uvacha, Brahman Brahman Nirdeshe, Nirgune Gunavrittaya, Katham Charinti Shrutaya, Shakshat Sad Asata Pare. So Parikshit Maharaj actually saying, O Brahmana, how can, so this Brahmana meaning obviously towards Sukadeva Goswami, he's saying, how can the Vedas directly describe the Supreme Absolute Truth, who can't be described in words? Okay, because the Vedas are limited to describing qualities of material nature. This is a very important thing to understand. The Vedas are actually obviously helping us in this material world. So they're describing things within material nature. But the Supreme is above these things. The Supreme is beyond material qualities. It's transcendental of all these material manifestations and their causes. How come the Vedas didn't describe this stuff? So Parikshit Maharaj is expressing doubt as to how the Vedas can talk about it, and even goes into the aspect that there are even different types of vritti, different types of ways of description, sabdavritti, right? And he says that if you look at any types of ways of describing, whether it's through literal, through analogy, like they have these Sanskrit terms like ruddha mukhya vritti and, you know, sabdavritti, and whether you describe literally or analogically, there is no way that you can actually describe the Lord. It doesn't make sense because the absolute is anirdesh, which means that it cannot be described by material parameters. Okay. So then Sukadeva Goswami in reply says, you're right. The Supreme Lord, he can't be described, but the Supreme Lord has given us our intelligence, our senses, our mind, our air, right? So that we can actually indulge in sense gratifications with the idea that after birth of sense gratification, engaging in fruitful activities, we become a bit more elevated and more elevated. And ultimately, we get to the stage where we attain this desire to actually have bhakti for Krishna. And then basically we can start to use our material senses to describe the Lord. So in the Garga Samhita, it's said that mundane language cannot describe the Lord. Okay, mundane language can, which is weird because we are talking in mundane language, right? But the point is that if we develop a desire to try and connect with Krishna and try to actually describe Krishna sincerely, right, then he will accept that description from us, even though it's imperfect. Okay. So he will agree to accept the glorification, right, by the kind of spiritual expression, the transcendental expressions of his loving devotees. And in the Garga Samhita, it gives the example in the purport, just like, you know, when you got like an important man, he relishes the address of a baby. You know, the baby goes like da, 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 goo, 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 you know, all that kind of stuff, baby talk, right? The father, he may be an important man, but he relishes that description from the baby, that talk from the baby. He won't relish it from anyone else. If someone else comes up to the big boss and starts talking to him, baby talk, he'd be like, what are you doing? Why are you talking to me like that? But because it's from the baby and he knows that the baby is reciprocating in a mood of love, even though the baby cannot convey what the baby's trying to say, but because the mood is there, then the father accepts it. Okay, similar, another analogy that I thought of as well is that, you know, when you got like a little kid and they draw like a cute little Mother's Day kind of like painting for their mum, you know, and it's, imagine it's a 5-year-old kid and they're just using some crayons and they're just like writing, like, you know, it's not like a Picasso masterpiece, you know, it's going to be like a circle with a stick figure and some, you know, scratchings on top with a crayon, and Happy Mother's Day, and it'd be like happy spelled H-A-P-I or something like that. But the point is that the mother will love it so much, and the mother will put it on the fridge with a magnet for the rest of the year until the next Mother's Day comes. Why? Because the mother is appreciating the endeavor, what that kid's doing. Okay? So if we endeavor for trying to connecting with Krishna, then Krishna will accept whatever expressions we give to him, okay? But not from anyone. It has to be for someone who's basically getting more and more devotional in his approach. And actually, in which case, if it's coming from a devotee, then descriptions are fine. In fact, one of the words used to describe the Lord is Uttama Sloka, means that he's described with expert poetry, okay? And in fact, this is the whole purpose for us to endeavor to try and connect with the Lord. Yesterday's class, Revati Nandan probably mentioned this quote from the Brihannaradaya Purana, that about the fact that if you're not using this human life for self-realization, then it makes you a miser. Okay? So, a couple of things we've touched on. So we've looked at the limitations we have okay, about why it's impossible for us to describe the Lord properly. But now let's look at the factors that allow us to describe the Lord. What are the two factors? So, two things, and this obviously, I'm sure a lot of us have heard of this because this is from the Damodarashtakam Leela, the Damodar Leela, is endeavor and mercy. Okay, two things. We endeavor and in return, we get mercy that helps us to describe the Lord more effectively. Okay, because without that, we cannot describe the Lord. We cannot have that deep realizations. We have especially, I mean, what to speak of great learned devotees. For us, as just like, you know, I speak for myself here, laymen, we are also, you know, burdened with the four defects, right? We commit mistakes. We fall into illusion. We have a tendency to cheat. We've got imperfect senses, right? So everything is basically going against us to make us unreliable in terms of describing the Lord. Okay, so therefore, one thing is that we endeavor, but we have to understand that we're depending on Krishna's mercy. Okay, in the Sudha Bhakti Chintamani by Shiva Maharaj, he mentions actually, the notion of mercy, it's there always in our spiritual path, but it really actually hits us when you get above the stage of Nishta. So when you get to the stage of Nishta, when the anarthas are coming out, anarthas also basically, you know, these anarthas, they delude us from thinking that we're still independent, that we're actually still somewhat in control of what we're doing and what we're not doing, right? But when you actually get to Nishta, when the anarthas are starting to really come out and you're really starting to get purified, right? Then you realize how dependent you really are, okay? Now, don't get me wrong. Before that, obviously, you know, it's almost like, you know, you're knowing the philosophy and you need it because you need to know where you're going. It needs to keep you grounded. But it's only when you get a past Nishta that you realize that actually everything I'm doing in devotional life is basically like, is basically just given to me by Krishna, like gifted to me by Krishna. And it's only through his potency that I'm actually getting pulled up. His potency and, of course, his devotees' potency, his representatives, they're the ones actually pulling me up, okay? There's a book actually by Sadaputta Prabhu where he talks about mechanistic and non-mechanistic theories. And it's almost like, you know, when you first endeavor in spiritual life and you're looking at things from a very kind of like scientific, analytical point of view and trying to put things into mechanistic paradigms. But then you get to a certain stage of advancement and you realize that actually the mechanistic paradigms and theories that I'm actually trying to employ here, at a certain point you realize that actually even these things are not working anymore. There's something beyond this. There's some non-mechanistic thing going on here that is not basically dependent on any kind of mechanical theory, right? And basically that's when the dependence grows even more. The understanding that actually, you know what? I wasn't actually doing anything anyway. It was actually just his mercy. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy, Krishna's mercy, that was actually pulling me up. So dependence is always there at every stage. For us, obviously, there's Krishna, but there's also Guru, Sadhu, Shastra. All these things are there that kind of actually makes us realize that actually is the mercy. But what the Krishna's looking at is for us to endeavor to connect with him. Okay? So does that mean that we don't study? Does that mean that we don't try and understand the philosophy? No, we do. Because we still need to be grounded. We still need to understand where we're going. And in fact, the first canto of Bhagavatam is actually known as, can be classed as Adhikari Tattva. It's establishing like the tattva to make us understand what's going on and how we go forward. Okay? And of course, there are certain key qualities. Buddha Bhavana Prabhu was recently saying to us in a group, that there are certain key elements that one should actually have if they want to actually develop their understanding. One is, and this is actually from Bhagavatam, first canto, first chapter, second verse. Dharma projita ketava paramo nidmatsaranam sata. So first is nirmatsara, without envy, right? You should develop a habit, a culture of having no envy within you, at least working on it. With that, shushrubi. You should have a culture of wanting to hear, wanting to understand what's going on, right? And with that, kritibi, right? So shushubi, kritibi, shushubi, kritibi, tatshanat, right? The last line of that verse. One has to have the right mentality. They have to be having a simple, pious mentality, trying to understand humbly without trying to challenge. Okay? With these things in mind, then we get more empowered to then actually describe more and more of the Lord's glories. Okay? So the whole point is that we are always at the basically at the mercy of the Lord. And even in terms of our descriptions, our knowledge and understanding, it's coming from the Lord. But at least we endeavor to try and understand. And it's only basically, you know, we endeavor right from the word go. From, you know, Sadhu Sangha, Bhajana Kriya, through Anatta Nivritti, we're still learning. We still have to develop our tattva. But it's only when we get to Nishta that we realize that actually, you know what? It was never me. It was always Krishna all along that was helping me. Okay. And obviously at the same time, making sure that we don't, you know, obviously cause offense in this process. It's interesting because we've got Sutta Goswami, who's basically, showing his humility and saying to them that, look, I'm only going to give you the realization as far as I can. And it's interesting because it was his father who was actually causing offense by not realizing his own limitations and then actually thinking that he's higher than he was. So then he obviously, he got, chastised, very properly, shall we say, by Lord Balaram with a blade of grass. Basic, you know, took his head off, right? So key things here, dependence and endeavor, they go together. But the, and actually this is our natural position, to be actually dependent on Krishna. It may seem like initially it might be a bit difficult because when we come to devotional life, we feel like we're in control. Like, okay, we are doing our sadhana. We're the ones waking up. We're the ones that are basically, you know, doing the activities. But it's only because we're still in that kind of ego platform. So, you know, we're not really fully conscious of how dependent we really are. But it's there within us. It's natural to us to be dependent. Like, for example, when a baby learns to walk, you know, walking is natural to any human being. But the initial stages, for a baby, it might seem a bit alien to try and walk. You know, like the mum has to basically grab the baby and go, come on, here you go, put that foot forward. No, all right, next foot forward. And it's almost like he's trying to learn something fresh. But actually, it's something that was already dormant within him, and it just needs to be re-triggered. Same with us. As we practice in our devotional life, and as we get more purified, we realize that dependence is actually our natural state of being. Right? We're not actually independent. To be independent is actually an unnatural state of being. Okay, so we've looked at limitations, we've looked at the factors that help us in overcoming these limitations, which is endeavor, our endeavor combined with the Lord's mercy. And of course, for us specifically, Lord's mercy manifests through the devotees. So that means associating the devotees, serving the devotees, like that. Okay, so what does that mean in terms of our modern approach to scriptures? Because the scriptures are vast, the Lord's glories are vast. We're trying to give spiritual knowledge here, but in one sense, we're basically trying to give knowledge on a topic which we really don't know like fully about. In fact, we probably know just a fraction of the, you know, full gamut of the Lord's glories, right? So what's our approach? Well, actually, in this chapter, in verse 7 of this chapter, there's a key word here. That is describing Parikshit Maharaj, how, because, you know, he's coming to the stage where he's got, like, you know, 7 days to live. He basically goes for the essence of life now. Sarabhuk. Sara means cream. Like, the, you know, the cream of something, the creme de la creme, right? So basically, he's getting to the essence of what this is, this whole life game is about, this game of life is about, okay? And that should be our approach to scriptures, right? It's impossible for us to describe the Lord's glories. In fact, it's even impossible for us to describe the Lord's energies, even his material energies. So we go for the Sara, right? One devotee recently was asking, why are dinosaurs not mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam, right? Why are dinosaurs not mentioned? It's interesting because actually there is a conversation with Srila Prabhupada where he does actually talk about dinosaurs, you know, saying that they're there, they are there, but, you know, maybe in different realms of consciousness, different levels of existence, you know? But that's a different topic. But the point is that the reason why dinosaurs are not mentioned is because Srimad Bhagavatam is looking at the Sara, the cream, the essence of what we need to know about life. Yes, it's giving you the whole summum bonum of what life is about, but the essence. It's not that Srimad Bhagavatam is giving us every little bit of everything. And this is why Sutta Goswami, when he's giving Srimad Bhagavatam this recitation to Parikshit to the sages at Naimisharanya, he's giving what the sages need to hear based on what Sukadev Goswami told Parikshit Maharaj. Okay? So one thing, and this is something that I think a lot of us, especially for us from Western backgrounds or living in the West, something that we often struggle with is looking at scriptures in a very literal, historical sense. Okay? Like, for example, you look at this this Srimad Bhagavatam, right? One of the things that always comes across, which is often is asked, is that, wait, you know that there's like layers upon layers of narratives in the Srimad Bhagavatam. I think at one point, the layers go up to seven. Seven layers. That's like a conversation within a conversation, within a conversation, within a conversation, basically times seven, right? And so it's like, okay, but who spoke first? And for us to know the Srimad Bhagavatam, who are we actually getting it from? Like, who spoke first to who? And who are the last two people to speak for us to understand it here? You know, like, there's all these kind of going back and forth as to who spoke it, what, getting the datings right and things like that. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that we should not try to, get as much of a structure on these scriptures from a kind of historical dating perspective. If we can, why not? In fact, if anything, it will probably help us to, connect more with the modern kind of culture of looking at things in a very linear approach. But at the same time, you have to understand that with the scriptures, and when these great learned devotees describe the knowledge, they're taking what we call an atemporal approach. Okay? In other words, they're basically getting to the essence of what should be said, as opposed to the narrative. All right? It's, you know, Bhakti Santa Maharaj talks about focusing on the honey instead of the jar. Right? So, and if you look at Sutta Goswami, he's got a very focused message, which is remembering Krishna at all times. That's basically Srimad Bhagavatam's aim. Bhakti. It's all about bhakti. Bhakti triumphs over everything. Bhakti triumphs over social indiscretions like Parikshit Maharaj, who's about to insult a brahmana, Shamik Rishi. Bhakti triumphs over uncomfortable interactions like Ambarish having an indiscretion with a brahmana like Dhruvasa. Bhakti trumps over the socially, at least of the time, socially unacceptable situation of a prostitute like Pingala becoming a wise teacher, right? Because bhakti goes above all of that. Bhakti goes above all social considerations, right? And historical considerations as well. So the idea is that in every single pastime, what is the essence that we're trying to get from this, right? Not so much the literal. Literal is important, but more the essence. And this is something that is basically a... we were having a seminar with Radhika Ramprabhu, and he's talking about history and the comparison between the Vedic way of looking at history and the kind of like the Western way, which is kind of based on kind of Christian traditions and things, where, you know, in the Western sense, history is going in a line, okay? History is going in a line from start to finish. And especially if you're looking at it from a Christian perspective, the Lord makes his will known through history. History is a tool in the hands of God, okay? History is one directional. Whereas in the Vedic tradition, history is cyclical. So in one sense, and I mean this in a respectful way, it's not going anywhere. It's basically just going round and round and round. History in itself is not purposeful from a Vedantic perspective. Okay? It's just going round in circles. And basically, if you look at the Vedantic perspective, God, basically Krishna, he's dipping into history as an avatar now and again, right? Here, here, here. And he's adjusting things, helping people out. But the overall force of history is just going round. And basically Krishna's coming in here and there. And basically it's those bits where Krishna is coming, dipping in and out of history, right? That is basically what is the, for us, the important things in the Bhagavatam for these great and learned devotees. Not that the entirety of history is a grand tool, okay? So it's a bit of a slight change in perspective. And this is something that we can see that is that's why you find that there are sometimes contradictions in the Bhagavatam on the pastimes. Like in some pastimes, you have the same pastime and different versions of it because they're happening at different times. Like in one example, Krishna doesn't marry his gopis. They are not part of his 16,108 wives. He simply marries them in spirit. But in other version of the same pastime, he marries them. How do we understand that? Right? And you know, we know the classic one, Varaha Avatar. Sometimes it comes in a red form, sometimes in a white form, right? At one point, Jiva Goswami, you know, he also talks about this, that Bhagavatam is existing in various planets, right? Simultaneously. So the boundaries of what is like, you know, sort of trying to conceptualize it with empirical parameters, when it comes to Vedic knowledge, it gets a little tricky here, which is again also showing the unlimited aspect of trying to describe Vedic knowledge, right? Which is why, again, same thing which we're emphasizing here, is that it's all about the sada. It's all about being a sada book, getting the essence. There was once a conversation between Srila Prabhupada and his disciples regarding printing and editing of his books. And there was a great devotee, disciple of Prabhupada, I'm sure a lot of you have known him, legendary devotee, called Yashoda Nandan Prabhu, right? And he was very much involved in the, you know, book development of Prabhupada. And one of the examples they had was when coming to a chapter on pinpointing Lord Narasimhadev's pastimes. Right, Lord Narasimhadev's pastimes. And I think for most of us, I think we're familiar with the aspect that his pastime took place in South India. At least this is the kind of the common understanding, in a place called Ahovalam. Right? So Yashoda Nandan Prabhu is actually saying to Prabhupada that we should let's map it out. Let's put this pastime in our books, right? And so he actually traveled to South India, right, and he consulted the Puranas. Right, Narasimha Purana, Brahmanda Purana, to actually pinpoint that yes, the Narasimhadev pastime took place in Ahovalam. And then he looked at Ramanujacharya's quotes. He also mentioned that it took place in Ahovalam. And then it was also corroborated by the Alvars, you know, the South Indian invasion of saints called the Alvars. So in one sense, he had very good, strong reasoning to put that in the book, right? That yes, look, he got Guru there, Ramanujacharya. He got a Shastra there, Narasimha Purana, Brahmananda Purana, Puranas basically, and he got the verdict of the Sadhus, Guru Sadhu Shastra, right? The Alvars, they all corroborated that it took place in Alvar on top of the hill, where the pillar was. You know the pillar where Narasimhadev comes out of, right? And so he went to Prabhupada and he sought confirmation so he can put it in the book. And Prabhupada actually said to him, confirmation or no confirmation, you just worship him. Wherever the pastime has taken place, it's not important. Okay, it's not important. So, you know, Yashoda Nandan Prabhu was kind of like perplexed. It's like, but it's there. And anyway, so he left it because he saw that Prabhupada's mood was, it's not important, right? Then later on, because what happens at the time, there's also some controversies of where exactly did it take place, right? Because most people, I think, nowadays recognize it being in Ahovalam, but there is still theories that it could have been in another place as well, or different places. So Yashoda Nandan Prabhu wanted to resolve this controversy. Okay? He actually says that he actually done another conversation. He approached Prabhupada again, saying that, Prabhupada, shall we look at this again, you know, to see if we can pinpoint? And Prabhupada said to him, look, as soon as there is controversy, avoid it. Narasimhadev is everywhere. That's it. Okay? And, you know, Yashoda Nandan Prabhu, I think he pushed Prabhupada a couple more times. And every single time, Prabhupada refused to entertain this question of where the pastime took place. And he actually said to Yashoda Nandan Prabhu that it's not important. What is important? Curing the person or finding out where it's coming from, where the disease is coming from. Okay? So it's interesting that Prabhupada was, you know, like, even though, like, you know, it would have been, at least from an external viewpoint, especially from when you're looking to give Krishna consciousness in a wider, you know, strata of society beyond, like, Vedic communities in India or something, you know, it may think that, okay, it's good to map things out. But Prabhupada was like, no, stick with the essence, especially when there's controversy there or different opinion. Give the essence every single time, especially when we're not always fully sure as to what's going on. Okay? So, Alice, again, you can see the difference between the Western concept, where the Western concept of history is to try and literally map things out, you know, which is why, you know, when Mahaprabhu told his Goswami disciples to, find out the places in Vrindavan, they found out the places through their divine revelation. But since then, it's not that, you know, bhaktas have gone out to do like massive archaeological excavations to try and, you know, dig up the remains where the pastimes took place. Like, we just know that those are where the pastimes took place, and we go there for pilgrimage and things. Because the essence is this helping me in my bhakti, right? And this is like, this is basically what Sutta Goswami's going to basically share with the sages here. He's giving them a very bhakti-centered discourse, okay? Now, saying that, we may still use the kind of the Western modern concept of trying to map out, spiritual knowledge with empirical measurements. Firstly, if it's a dead cert that we can do it, right? And it's basically, we have to do it consciously when we know when to use what. For example, Prabhupada did put down directions to places in the purports to the CC. Like, you know, you turn this way, take a right, pass this station, and go there, and you find that place there. You find the house of this acharya or something, right? So, and he did it with a very, that mood of, okay, if this is going to help people to have some empirical validity of what they're trying to understand, then fine. But it does not take away from the main understanding is what's the sada that we're trying to get to here. Okay? So this is, it's important to know this. So when we're looking at Vedic pastimes, especially when new people come to Krishna consciousness, they may struggle with the narratives, right? When we read Bhagavatam, at some point we forget what's happening where, right? Or we see contradictions in the pastimes that, wait, hang on, this happened here. I remember once reading, like, you know, Hiranyakashipu was based in South India, or another time I heard that it was based in a place called Multan, which is in like Pakistan now, right? And then at the same time, he was also like, you know, conquering the whole universe. And I was thinking, wait, wouldn't he have like a base like in another planet or something, you know, where he's running the whole universe? So it's like, but the point is that, yeah, we can try to figure it out. But remember, these things happened so long ago and they're so vast in their scope. How are we going to really try and literally map it out? But at least we get the sada, the cream of what is being trying to be said here. Okay, so with that in mind, I'll finish off on the last point is, so if the great learned devotees like Sutta Goswami are themselves, like in this verse, showing that I'm limited in what I can give you, nonetheless, I'll do my best. That's basically what he's saying, right? So what makes someone great and learned? You don't know fully the topic you're talking about, right? Like, not fully, which is fair enough, because even in modern day discipline, it's not that experts know fully their topics. So what makes you great as a devotee? What makes you learned, right? So we've established one thing is that a great learned devotee, they always like the Sala book, like Parikshit Maharaj, Sukadev Goswami, Sutta Goswami, okay? And this actually even translates. Now here you can see that from the next verse onwards, which will happen on Tuesday, right? Sutta Goswami is effectively taking the role of a guru. He's giving his disclaimers. Okay, you want to know from me? This is where I'm at right now and what I can give you. But with that in mind, obviously the sages were more than happy to hear from him, and rightfully so. So he kind of takes on the role of a guru, okay? And, you know, we may have this idea that guru knows everything. Well, in one sense, yes, but he knows everything about what is important, okay? One of the qualities of a guru is that he is heavy, okay? Heavy means not physically heavy, right? It means heavy in the sense that you can't move him from his position. And what is his position? He is fixed at the lotus feet of Krishna. Okay? Other people may be light. They may be shaken on their path. Right? Like light trees. It's interesting. They say that when you get to Nishta, the tree of your bhakti becomes firm and thick, strong trunk. It can't be swayed by the wind. In other words, the tree of your bhakti becomes heavy. So similarly here, right? The spiritual master, the guru, is heavy. He cannot be shaken from his course, which is, of course, at the feet of Krishna. So you see that a strong guru is someone that, you know, years and years and years and years, he's still there, still serving Krishna, still talking about Krishna, still chanting Hare Krishna. Other things may happen, you know, prime ministers may change, presidents may change, other devotees may come and go, some devotees will change here and change there, and, you know, you may see someone coming into Krishna consciousness and, I haven't been around for so many long because of life, you know, life comes in and things like that. And then may ask the guru, like, what about you? And the guru will be like, I'm still here, I'm still chanting Krishna consciousness, I'm still chanting Hare Krishna, right? Whatever's changing, the spiritual master does not change. Nothing's changed there for him. He's still carrying on doing what he's doing. Okay? So this is one of the key qualities of a great learned devotee. Sutta Goswami's qualification, more than his breadth of knowledge about the Bhagavatam, which of course is, you know, considerable, more than any of us in the modern age, most likely. But the point is that he's fixed. He's living the philosophy. He's practicing it. And that's more important. Yes, knowledge is important. That's why I mentioned that all devotees should, you know, the first canto, the second canto, the Bhagavatam is there to develop the tattva of an adhikari. Adhikari tattva is there to help us, get us grounded and help us to move forward, right? So you've got sufficient knowledge. But after that, right, what's more important is being immovable, being heavy, sticking with what you're doing, okay? It's not about being the greatest intellectual on the planet. It's not about quoting more verses than anybody else. It's not about explaining the most complicated philosophy or knowing the most stories or the most analogies. All these things are there. And remember, two qualities, endeavor and mercy. If you endeavor and knowing that Krishna is giving the mercy, Krishna will also give you the mercy to know what to say when, as he did with Sutta Goswami. Okay, so with that mind, with that mindset, Sutta Goswami then proceeded to start with his story on how Parikshit Maharaj got cursed by a Brahmana boy, and I'll finish off, and I'm happy to take questions if there are any. I'll finish off with this verse from the Brahma Samhita 5:33, very famous verse. Advaitamachutam anadimanantarupam adhya purana purusham navayovanam cha vedeshu durlabham adurlabham atma bhakto govindamadi purusham tamaham bhajami. I worship Govinda, the primeval lord, who is inaccessible to the Vedas. Interesting there. He's inaccessible to the Vedas. So, you know, in the Sanskrit, it says there, Vedeshu Dullabham Adullabham Atma Bhakto. Dullabham Adullabha. So in other words, a Vedic scholar may be very close to the Lord in terms of intellectual understanding, but at the same time, very far. Yeah, very close, but very far. Okay, but she's inaccessible to the Vedas, but obtainable by pure, unalloyed devotion of the soul. Who's without a second, who's not subject to decay, is without a beginning, whose form is endless, who is the beginning and the eternal Purusha. Yeah, and he's a person possessing the beauty of blooming youth. So in other words, yes, you can try and know the Lord through the Vedic knowledge and understanding, but more important than that is actually the devotion. And whether the devotion is what's going to actually help you to get close and close to the Lord. And this is basically what we can learn from Sutta Goswami's mood and his approach from this verse just before he actually starts his discourse on the story of Parikshit Maharaj. Okay, so I'll finish here. We talked about limitations. We talked about, what are the factors that can help us go beyond our limitations. We also, with those limitations in line, how should we approach the scriptures? And of course, and then through that, obviously, what our mood should be as well, and what was Sutta Goswami's mood, and what are the qualities of a person who's great and learned. It's not just about having lots of information and breadth of knowledge. It's something more than that.
Thank you so much, Mr. Kenshana Prabhu. It's very nice to hear this Harikatha. And how you mentioned that is in the stage of Nista, we really learn to, we realize we are dependent. And you later on give a very beautiful descriptions on how we Westerns, especially in this particular mindset, can have a better look at Srimad Bhagavatam in this way, can grasp the deep meaning of la crème de la crème, the cream of all the Vedas. So for the moment, there's only one question. I'm going to read it. Even though you mentioned, maybe it's good to repeat it. So Hari Bol, thank you for such insightful talk. You said that from devotees, God will accept descriptions about God. So from non-devotees, even if their description are not said with full love, will Lord not accept them still? He's all loving and accepting, so he would surely appreciate it, even if it's from a non-devotee. Thank you.
That's a thank you. Very good question there. Krishna does say in the Bhagavad Gita, "Ye yathamam prapadyante tam steva bhajamyaham." So in other words, the degree to which you're reciprocating with Krishna, to that degree, he will give you the understanding by which you can come to him, and obviously his connecting with him. So if a person who's not, let's say, a devotee, I mean, look, firstly, let's look at what it means, devotee. Devotee can be, obviously, on one hand, it's your practices, your sadhana, things like that. But it's also at the mood which you're connecting with Krishna and your intention to try and connect with Krishna, right? So obviously, if you have mixed intentions towards Krishna, I'm sure there will be certain reciprocation there. We know from the Bhagavad Gita, there are different levels of yoga. There is Sakam Karma Yoga, where you're trying to connect with Krishna, but at the same time, you've also got some desire for your own material benefit there, right? Then you get to Nishkam Karma Yoga, where you're not really doing it for yourself anymore. You're doing it for Krishna, but you may be attached to the way you're trying to connect with Krishna, right? So if a non-devotee tries to describe the Lord, if it's done with a sincere intention, there will definitely be reciprocation there. Whether it's a full reciprocation, I don't know. But there'll be certain reciprocation there. But the key thing is this, though, that if you're trying to describe the Lord in a certain way and the Lord reciprocates, the Lord may then also give you certain directions of how to then reciprocate with him as well. Right? The Lord will give you through gurus, sadhu, shastra. So if you are sincerely trying to reciprocate with the Lord, then you will also be willing to also take on certain processes and associations from the Lord that he gives you to help you reciprocate even more deeply, right? So you know what I mean? So definitely there will be reciprocation there based on the sincerity of intention. But also if you are sincere in intention, then at a certain point, the Lord may also then give you an opportunity to tap into a certain process to help you proceed further. At that point, if you then say to the Lord that, no, I'm going to do it my own way. I'm not going to go into following this process or whatever. I'm going to reciprocate with you the way I want. It's fine, but then is that full, what's the word? Full reciprocation, openness to be reciprocating with the way the Lord wants you to.
Thank you. So I would ask one more question. You said at the end, when you were mentioning that it's not about how many stories or verses we know, but that the Lord will let us know what to say and when to say it. So what's the substance of this? What is the mechanism, again, in this Western mind? Which is this coming from? How does it work? And how can we step into that state of it's kind of a spontaneous, or I don't know how it works. And
it will become spontaneous as you advance. Again, we look at the 9 stages of devotional service. Now, the initial stages when you're doing bhajana kriya and you're doing your sadhana, right? You're doing your sadhana bhakti. So for us, we follow the process, right? We follow a certain process of studying, sadhana, seva, sangha, all these things. We keep that formula, if you want to call it that, right? We keep that going, we keep that going. But internally, we understand that, okay, I'm doing this, but ultimately I know that it's not that I'm doing this and therefore I'm learning stuff. I'm doing this and I know that by doing this, I'm endeavoring to connect with Krishna. And then Krishna will then help me to develop what I need to get from this process. So again, it comes back to the both things, isn't it? Endeavor and mercy. Mercy is an internal mood that we have to have, right? And the endeavor is external actions that we still have to do, right? So for example, us, like, you know, let's say verses and stories. Yeah, we learn stories. Why not? We should learn stories and scriptures and shastras and things like that. We may not even remember. Here's another thing, right? You know, sometimes when you're studying and you've got like all these, you know, you're learning pastimes after pastimes, right? Bhagavatam class. And then, you know, in your case, probably doing your Monday morning brahmachari class or something, you know, after breakfast and learning the sloka, things like that, right? But the point is that you're learning, you may not remember everything at the same time. I remember when I first came to the ashram and I used to get worried that, you know, I'm learning, I'm taking all these notes, but when I'm learning new slokas, I'm forgetting my older slokas, right? Or I'm learning this stuff, but I'm forgetting what I learned, like, you know, in the beginning. And, you know, it's like, how am I feeling it all in my head, right? But then you realize, no. You just keep learning, do the process. What happens is as you then, let's say you start to share that Krishna consciousness with others, someone asks you a question, and then suddenly you just remember like a story that comes to your head, which, oh yeah, I didn't remember that story for a long time. That just suddenly came to my head because it's relevant for the question. So it's almost like you have to kind of let go then and let Krishna come in and basically, you know, like, you know, just inspire to give out the knowledge for what you've been learning that's all there in your mental repository, you know? So so that's where the mercy comes in. That's when the surrender to Krishna's mercy comes in. Endeavor is we do actively try and know as much as we can about this person called Krishna. And the mercy comes in that as I know, I leave it with you how you want to then use me as an instrument in your plans.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Another question came from Arika. How do we see the mercy of the Lord when we see a leadership fall down and when their unfortunate diplomatic character is revealed to us through Krishna's arrangement? How do we overlook such intelligence that Krishna gives us to see that truth? Why does reveal such knowledge to us? Is it going to hurt us and confuse us?
Okay, so a few things here to consider is Krishna's mercy is there available for everyone who takes to it. When you see a leadership falls down and things, it's remember that Krishna's not going to force you to come to him. It's our choice how we come to him. Okay, so the degree to which you reciprocate that degree, he'll pull you up. At the same time, it's your sincerity of intention of how strictly you want to obviously stick with Krishna's plans and things like that. Also, remember that Maya's energy is also considerable, right? And Maya does strike at any time. They say that in anattas, the offenses, causing offenses is one of the most biggest anattas that we have. And it sticks us right the way up to bhav, possibly even the early stages of prema. Okay, so when we see like a leadership fall down or something like that happening, we shouldn't be shocked by it. We should look at it this way. He reciprocated a lot with that person, reciprocated a lot with Krishna, but he still had some anattas in him, and he maybe wasn't always careful with certain aspects of his discipline, which is why then those little anattas restricted him from completely reaching the goal that he wanted to get to. Okay. It's a lesson for us to never underestimate the power of Maya and to always be vigilant in our practice of Krishna consciousness. At the same time, understanding that we're not here to judge such people as well, right? Because the example is given that let's say you have a person and he's really advancing. And then let's say he comes to a certain stage and he falls down. When he falls down, he don't fall like this. He's basically gone to like this side here, right? He's come off the path a bit. But remember, we're not there to judge that person because we're still down here. So whichever way you look at it, he's still up here somewhere, you know. So we should still respect such people and understand such devotees, understanding that that's their journey with Krishna. And, you know, if they fell down, but they still attained a high level of advancement, when they get back onto Krishna consciousness, they'll rapidly come up to where they left off. Example, I'll give an example here. You have Bharat Maharaj, right? Bharat Maharaj was an amazing devotee, as we all know. He got to the bhava level of bhakti. And then after the after that stage, he, you know, we know the past time he obviously got attached to a deer and, you know, fell down. Now, of course, for him to fall down, that doesn't mean that he fell down and we should just reject him, because then he came back again, right? And then he came back as obviously as a deer, and then he had all his memory of himself as a bhakta, and then he came back again as Jadbara, and he finished his goal. So he rapidly basically progressed from where he went from. Neha bikrama nasosti pratavaya navidyate, right? There is no loss or diminution in what a person's bhakti. At the same time, in the Bhagavatam, it also mentions that one of the reasons he fell down was because of lack of association, not so much the affection for the deer, but lack of association. So therefore, as we mentioned, one of the key things that we need when we're progressing in our bhakti is association, serving and associating with the devotees, particularly pure devotees or at least very advanced devotees. Okay. So any aspect of your practice that, let's say, gets neglected for whatever reason, then that can also be like a little trip that, you know, that will temporarily restrict you from attaining the top. So when we see these fall downs, we should see them in that perspective that, okay, he practiced, he's got great, great progress in his advancement, but maybe there was some negligence in some area where he's temporarily tripped up. But we also have to understand that he will rapidly, he as in the devotee, will rapidly pick himself up by Krishna's grace, and they'll progress rapidly from where he tripped up from. So it's nothing for us to be confused by or hurt by. We should just see it as this is mature world, and the, you know, the mature energy is strong, but we just keep carrying on no matter what.
Thank you so much, Prabhu.